This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Eek. COVID-19 ravaged the country in 2021, but the tide eventually turned when the effects of the nationwide vaccination program kicked in. Now, this was no mean feat because it included reaching those in rural communities as well as those who are elderly, less mobile, and even the bedridden. So in the final episode of this short series where we are reflecting on 2021, we're speaking to two medical NGOs that were crucial in the battle against the pandemic. And earlier we heard about Imarat's efforts to support the response at the COVID assessment centres. Now I'm speaking to Dr. Muralithara Munisamy, Managing Director of the National Cancer Society of Malaysia, about how NCSM has been crisscrossing the country to get the jabs into people's arms, what that experience has been like and what are some lessons learned. Murali, thanks so much for joining us today. So I think to start with, before we start looking at what NCSM was involved in, what were your concerns for cancer, people living with cancer at the start of the year, especially before vaccinations kicked off?
Thank you so much, Shawik. Always a pleasure to be with you all. Actually, one of our main concerns was, look, we're getting data that people who lived with cancer actually were a lot more higher risk of getting COVID. So I think that, and because of that, we knew that a lot of people were just not coming into hospitals to get treatment, which they needed at that point in time. So this really was a major concern as the disease began.
All right.
So we needed to get them safe somehow.
Mm-mm. And when you say safe, that's vaccination, isn't it? That's making sure that they, as among the most vulnerable, could be protected as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So NCSM, was involved with COVID-19 vaccination efforts throughout the year. You know, take us back to how that got started and, why was this important for NCSM to be involved in?
Just to share with you, we continue to be actively involved. I just jabbed my sixth Pfizer patient about 20 minutes before this for today. So, and surprisingly, one of those patients was a primary series patient, which means someone who has not been vaccinated as yet.
So there are still
pockets of people who are still left behind. So how did we get started into this? It's like I said, for us, it was originally, it's like everybody was asking, I think continue to ask, hey, you guys are cancer guys, why are you all involved in COVID-19 vaccination? So for the society, it's been a conscious decision. As I said, we knew that Ministry of Health Resources, especially during that peak of COVID, was spent in terms of fighting COVID itself. We knew that we had to go and sort out this group of people, especially those most vulnerable. And really in this pocket of like people like cancer patients, we have your infirm, your elderly, your bedbound patients. So we know this is a pocket that it's not even commercially viable to do. And these people can't come to PPVs. So these were part of the thought processes of why society said, look, we will go and we will get this done. Turun padang lah, so as to speak.
Quite literally, turun padang. Tell us first, the sort of planning that would go into an effort like this, right? How do you know where to go and who to reach?
Oh, wow. So that is actually a story worth telling in itself, simply because, and I think this is where our kind of like IMARED, us, the Red Crescent, all of the other societies who have been working on the ground for a very, very long time, we've got that kind of, I suppose, a mix of social capital as well as kind of alliances, networks with a lot of organizations on the ground. So, for example, always pick up small places in small towns, for example, like Tapa. People know where Tapa is, or even Bido. Small things like there's small places like Cenderiang or Mamang Di Awan. All these places are little towns that no one really knows. But we have smaller organizations which work on the ground there. These are community organizations. These are sometimes residents associations. These are sometimes people with diabetes associations who are working with patients in that area. And so we have worked with all these organizations in the past. And it didn't take much for us to actually pick up the phones and start calling all our networks that have been active on the ground for many, many years. So then from then, it's a matter of getting them out. So it basically ran on a hub and spoke kind of mechanism. Hub and spoke in the sense that we sitting in the center, we actually reached out to, as the hub, we reached out to spokes, smaller organizations in the periphery. They in turn reached out directly to patients on the ground, assessing the need, getting patient information, and coming back to us and saying, look, in this area, there's 10 people, these are the addresses, and these are the people who needed vaccination. And I'd be sorely amiss if I didn't tell you that how big the contribution of these colleagues of ours was on the ground. So whenever we went in, vaccination teams went up from KL or other big cities in which NCSM kind of centers are located. And when they went into the peripheries, these organizations, volunteers who worked with these organizations came out to guide us to these houses of the patients who they worked with, or, you know, people who they knew, who they had picked up. So that was the only way we got this done.
So you were going from door to door, weren't you?
Literally.
Tell us what a typical day looked like.
Okay, so a typical day for a door-to-door program really depended on where we went. So in the Klang Valley, you had nice roads and, you know, at least the cars don't get damaged as much. And generally with, this is how sadly we've become dependent on technology, with Google Maps or Waze, then, you know, you put in an address and you mapped where you went. So generally we had a call center team working on the back end. They would call these patients usually 3 days before, and then 1 day before again, to confirm that how many people were in the house, how many people needed to get vaccinated, were people sick, or were, you know, did they need some kind of intervention, was the house under quarantine? And then they would generally map, give each mobile team a map. So within this map, it gives you kind of the most optimum coverage. So on a really good day within the Klang Valley, you could do something like about 30 houses. So which meant anything between, if each house had, could range anything between one patient. We've even had houses when there were 10 patients. I mean, 10 residents in the same house. Because early on, working with Ministry of Health, we decided at that time, at the peak of COVID, that look, we needed to vaccinate everyone in the household. So you could do something, theoretically, between 100 or just maybe about 30. Sometimes you turned up at these homes after maybe about 20 or 30 minutes apart, to find out sometimes that the patient had passed away during the night. So at that time, then, you know, if we wouldn't get to vaccinate, that's an extreme ending now. But sometimes it's more like people get quarantined over the night, they find out they've been exposed. So then when the team goes in, they actually don't get to go into the house to vaccinate. So that's in lovely places which have roads. In slightly smaller or more rural areas, like even we did a lot of Penang and Kedah, even Pahang, sometimes houses are about 40 or 50 minutes apart. And there's little, if any, kind of guidance from maps. So it's a lot of drive, stop, ask for directions. I think my worst personal experience in this whole time was looking for one house in Sabah Bernam, which is not too far away.
That's right.
Yeah, but it took me 2 hours, 45 minutes to actually find that house. A really difficult house, anyway.
But you got there in the end.
Absolutely. So, so that's the kind of challenge that we've had in many places, especially in Penang and Kedah. We did a lot of mainland Penang and quite a bit of Kedah. And in those places, many places were inaccessible by car. So you literally had to park and then walk. I think the furthest some of my colleagues walked was about 1.8, 1.9 kilometers to get to a house through Sawabadi. So you literally get all this high-tech technology of Pfizer vaccines in a nice high-tech cold box, and then everybody's got their pants rolled up and walking in the water. So it's very contrasting image.
Yeah. Did you cover Sabah and Sarawak as well?
I don't know whether we had the fortune or the misfortune to not to be able to cover Borneo. So there were other organizations that actually did it, including the Ministry of Health's own teams. And I think Red Crescent helped a little bit in certain areas. I'm not very sure about this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Resources. Was it all coming out of, I mean, apart from the vaccines being supplied under the National Vaccination Program, you know, all of this is cost, isn't it? Getting people out on the ground. Who covered these resources?
Okay, so as a healthcare provider, we were, the Ministry of Health contracted us under Protect Health. Protect Health is the corporation that, you know, kind of oversaw, continues to oversee the vaccination process. And Protect Health is basically the payer, and we're the kind of implementer, contractee and the contractor as well. So Protect Health has been very kind, and Protect Health has been very efficient in kind of laying out the kind of systems for us to go out into different areas and all that. So kudos to them for that, and the kind of support they've given us. So in terms of remuneration, we got the same 14 ringgit per dose. This was, so we were compensated for that amount. But as you can see, like for example, on an average day, you covered something like about 280 to 300 kilometers by car, and your petrol wouldn't cut it.
Yeah.
So, and this is not even including the kind of human resources, the other kind of costs associated. So what we did have is, so the society put up the large bulk of that money, because like I said, it was a commitment we consciously went into. Of course, we received the kind of remuneration from Protect Health, and that really helped as well to defray some of those costs. But I think quite a bit of the human costs were covered by many of our volunteers, in terms of we would have been never able to recompensate them at actual value. So, for example, like doctors, nurses, medical graduates, all these people came out for a pittance. We basically, like, you know, gave them a stipend, which I think covered meals, and that's what it's like, nowhere near commercial value, nowhere, maybe a tenth of what their time would have been. But these people came up and they continue to come up, they continue to help us. Last week, for example, we vaccinated in Temerloh, and we have started giving boosters now for Orang Asli communities, and we had almost about 20 doctors come up, many of them driving at their own cost to come to these various Orang Asli villages in Temerloh to actually vaccinate. So that's how we've been able to.
So you put out a call and, you know, people, especially in the vicinity, have responded.
Especially, they have, especially from the medical fraternity, but we've also been really lucky. We've had a lot of good support from non-medical organizations as well as industries as well. Mm. Quite a lot of people have actually put up donations to the society to help support vaccination, because they know they have the money that we've spent. And really, we'd have to single out organizations like Rotary, Damansara, because what they've been doing for months at end is actually giving us drivers and cars on weekdays and weekends to actually help us move the medical teams from house to house. So it makes it so much more easier because they give us logistics.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You know, what was it like? What was the reception when you went door to door? You know, how did the people receive you? Was there anyone who was hesitant about getting vaccinated?
Okay, so again, three types of people. One, and sadly, this is a horrible thing to say, people in the more rural areas, I think, were a lot more appreciative of the efforts. You know, people were just so kind. You got people who, you know, even prepared meals, people come up, like I was telling you, when we were in very rural areas, sometimes it's difficult to get addresses. They would come up kilometers away and wait for you to bring you in. Mm. And these were not the patients. These were sometimes just neighbors or even people living within that space, you know, just friends of friends. So that was the kind of reception. And then, of course, you got the vaccine hesitant, or the anti-vax, the different pocket of people. So the vaccine hesitant people, which is when the medical teams went, a lot, most of our health professionals were briefed. We actually had briefings for them. We told them how to manage anti-vax kind of comments, or people who were hesitant. So sometimes we'd spend up to an hour in a house counseling a person to, you know, take a vaccine. Mm. So this... you had this kind of reception as well. But at the same time, you know, you get the people screaming at you, oh, I've been waiting for you since 4 o'clock, it's 4:20, why have you not come? Not understanding, like, you know, a lot of the teams start at about 6:30 in the morning, and they're all, like, doing it, and it's an entirely voluntary job. So sometimes there's a bit of that unfriendliness, lah. And that, unfortunately, happened quite a bit in more urban areas rather than rural areas, lah. So, but overall, it's been very fulfilling. And very, very inspiring, actually.
Mm-hmm. I mean, having said that, for the team, I'm sure it is inspiring. But, you know, having met some of the negative reception, you know, and really the exhaustion of doing this, you know, sort of round the clock for the whole year, how has your team been coping?
They have been coping very, very well. Amazingly, sometimes I continue to, I think, come to work every day because of the people I work with, you know, and even like so, even people like our president, Dr. Soundari, has literally vaccinated as many people as I have. That's a couple of thousand people. So she's driven people across into rural areas. So it's been really
everybody hands on deck.
Working, yeah, all hands on deck. And most importantly, of course, people are sometimes just exhausted. Up to the point of, like, you know, they just drop out for a couple of days out of sheer exhaustion, and then they just swing back in. So we've been doing that. But like I said, the good thing we have is we have really a lot of volunteers who've been coming into our business. It's really helped turn the tide for us as well.
Any stories you can share? You know, something that you will remember of this whole process?
Oh, I think... I suppose a very funny story of sorts. I think we have vaccinated. I mean, a lot of, like, a mixture of really happy and sad stories. I think, but the one of the funnier ones was we helped vaccinate an old lady who was 108 years old. And this was in Pahang. And after we vaccinated, and this auntie is like quite, she's not bedbound. She's just old and frail, mm-hmm. but she's very vocal. She's elderly Chinese matron, you know, and, you know, matriarch like that. And then a lot of people in that area were not keen to receive vaccinations, right? So after you vaccinated her the first time, quite a lot of people in that area didn't get vaccinated. They were not keen at all. So when we came back for the second dose, I think one of my colleagues who actually had been speaking to her son was in the 70s. So she had asked, she had demanded that the whole kind of surrounding, I don't know, about 20 houses or so, all of them to turn up. Mm-hmm. And then she sat on this chair right outside the house in her porch. Mm-hmm. This is a Chinese new village. And she's got all these people lining up, just screaming at them. She said, "Hey, you morons, you know, I am 108. Look, I've taken my second shot." After she took the second shot, and she was like, "I don't care. These people have come all the way. All of y'all get vaccinated. You know, if no means, y'all don't deserve to live, blah, blah, blah." So it's hilarious. So it was like a different level of advocacy. Yeah. So it was very exciting.
Yeah. And did they all get vaccinated?
I don't think anyone would have dared to go against the... she would have killed them alive.
You're absolutely right. This is the kind of advocacy we need, right? At different levels.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and then, like, very, very touching. You see, sometimes in Kedah, we saw, like, a certain Malay young men, absolutely nothing to do with the movement, nothing to do with the organizations we worked with. They would see us... like packing drinks or something, and then they would ask, "Hey, look, do you all need help? Do you need guidance?" So they would then leave their jobs, you know, and pick up motorbikes and come with us to go and show us where houses were, where people were vaccinated. People offered houses for shelter when we were stuck in rains. You know, it's just very heartwarming.
Absolutely. Were there other challenges apart from, you know, sort of getting around the logistics of that, everything that you've just described? Anything else that presented
a
hurdle?
Oh my God, there's a special nightmare that I have to describe to you. It's the nightmare of the last dose. Okay, so as you know, we practice a no wastage policy. Right, especially, and we still do. I think we're one of the organizations with the lowest rate of vaccine wastage. What does that mean is, you know, when you break open a Pfizer, in most of the time with the bedbound and all that, we use the Pfizer vaccines. And the problem with the Comirnaty or Pfizer vaccine is it comes in 6 doses, yeah. right? And so when you open a vial, you need to give it to 6 people,
yeah.
which is absolutely fine. We've got a PPV with 2,500 people. You can regulate how many people are coming through the door. And so the nightmare is in home-to-home vaccination, you dilute, you open the vial, and then one after another, the houses after that say that, oh, look, I'm sick. I cannot get the vaccine. So the patient died. And so you're stuck with the last 3 doses, or the last 2 doses. You don't want to waste them. It needs to go into an arm. And that is a logistical nightmare.
So what were you doing?
The latest. You have to literally go and like sell goreng pisang, drive around looking for people who haven't got vaccinated, beg them to take the shot and push the shot into them. So the latest we've done that. Me personally, I've had other teams get stuck at very similar kind of timings. It's 1:20 a.m.
Oh my goodness.
To actually finish that last 1 dose more. Oh dear. So I get nightmares going to sleep at night thinking about the last dose of Pfizer. So yeah, that is a nightmare. So now I think the government is switching. We at that time, we didn't have the option of CanSino. CanSino is a beautiful vaccine. It's a single, for many reasons. It's a good vaccine, but I find it very exciting because it's a single dose, comes in a single package.
Mm.
So I don't have a headache of looking for that last two for this. To vaccinate, yeah.
So that's what kept you at night, the last dose in that vial. You're still going on with this because there's booster doses to be given out now. What could have been done better? What would you like to see to improve the efforts? And, this isn't going to end. We still have kids to vaccinate next year. What could have been done better to help these kinds of outreach efforts?
Okay, so in terms of outreach, I think I have to tell you, we're one of the most successful stories in the world, Malaysia. At the speed at which we rolled out, and really, a lot, like I said again, a lot of kind of cool, like pats on the back, need to go to Protect Health Club for actually putting this all together very quickly, off the bat, young organization, small organization, and then they just hit the ground and just started running. And so in terms of outreach, I think we were writing the book as we went along, continuously and consistently. You know, every day was a new day. Everybody didn't know what we were doing. And we all learned as quickly as we could. So if as we go back into this, maybe round two for booster doses, right? I think what could be planned better was if we probably had integrated this. I think this was the big challenge. Right. So ministry. So many a times we had to revisit the same places over and over again for a different set of patients. So we go sometimes to the same taman on a Monday, and then we get a call again on like Wednesday or Thursday. We get a new list of names. And then we're like 2 houses away. You had another 3 patients that we didn't know about. So you have to go back again and revaccinate that set of people. So it's logistically didn't make much sense. You don't have a master list. And this is kind of, I think, a learning for both us as well as for all these government institutions. For example, people who are disabled come under Jabatan Kebajikan Masyarakat if they receive some kind of assistance. So you get a list from Jabatan Kebajikan Masyarakat that had this list of people. However, if you were disabled but you didn't receive any benefits, depending on whether you had a severe illness, then you would be under like a Ministry of Health list from the local clinic. So unfortunately, if you're disabled, but you're relatively well, you don't have regular follow-ups, then you don't fall anywhere.
Mm.
So, and the Ministry of Health list doesn't necessarily talk to the Jabatan Kebajikan Masyarakat list. So sometimes you've got lists from different places at different times. So collating and collecting that together, it proved to be a challenge in terms of when you went to deliver. So it's a lot of like repeated vaccinations in the same area, logistics. So I think that drove up costs quite a bit as well. So the only hurdle in redoing this, I think, which now we would have overcome since now we have all those lists, perhaps consolidated already, is that if we could have these kind of resources earlier.
Is there a danger of people slipping through the cracks and being missed out?
For sure, Ma, as I told you, at the time we're doing this interview, I'm still vaccinating primary series, you know. So, and this was a Malaysian, so I'm thinking that in some cases, these are genuinely people who are disabled, whose families were very, like today, this person was a disabled person who was just never had the resources to actually come out and was too scared to actually deploy, come out anywhere and fell through the cracks, didn't know about the program as well. So I suppose you still get people who fall through the cracks.
Yeah. What are your hopes for 2022?
No more booster. I'm hoping that this round of booster vaccinations would have stabilized enough, hopefully, because we get to see the long-term effects of how long they will last in terms of efficacy. So hopefully it's enough to get people back on track. Hopefully the virus kind of mutates onto a variant that's very mild so that it turns into a normal cold flu or something like that. And we can get back to everything else that we're doing before.
That's right.
Treating cancer.
That's right. You have lots of other duties, to take care of as well. But, NCSM has been doing such a tremendous job. Thank you so much for all your efforts. Along with other NGOs, you mentioned Red Crescent, Imaret, Mercy Malaysia, and many other, like you said, the community, the small community organizations in the different areas that have really pulled together. I've been speaking to Dr. Murali Tharamunisamy, Managing Director of the National Cancer Society of Malaysia, and this has been our look back on the year that was really on the ground, people and organizations that have been fighting the pandemic on the front lines. You've been listening to Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.